You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show.
We're continuing our look at the book Multipliers, How the Best Leaders Make Everyone Smarter by Liz Wiseman and with a foreword by Stephen Covey. Last show, we're looking at multipliers, specifically the investor. Next section, how to stretch the role. We consistently find that multipliers get twice the capability from their people that diminishers do. And time after time, people tell us how multipliers not only get 100% from them, but they got 120% or even more. Multipliers do get more than 100% of people's capabilities because people grow under the watch of a multiplier. One way that multipliers incite this growth is by asking people to stretch and do something they've never done before. Consider these three individuals. Eleanor Schaffner Mosch was a champion who needed a bigger cause. As the marketing director for a small IT practice inside Bose Allen Hamilton in 1988, she ran basic demand generation programs. But when Bose decided to turn over the reins of the IT practice to a different partner who was intent on transforming the function, she suddenly found herself with a really big job. Within months, she was organizing a corporate-wide kickoff event to launch the vision for the IT practice. Next, she convened a forum on top of CIOs in the world. When she found herself sitting next to the CEO of Bose Allen Hamilton during one of these meetings, she confidently explained to him why the IT industry and the IT practice inside the firm was going to change the world. She said, quote, "I wasn't afraid of anything or of anyone. We knew that we were doing and we felt that we could do anything," unquote. Mike Hagan was ready to take on the world, but he literally needed a passport. He worked as the director of sales operations for the billion-dollar U.S. sales division of a multinational company. His job was to make sure the sales force complied with a company policy. When the president of the sales division wanted to globalize and grow the business, he tapped Mike to figure all of this out. One day, Mike was the policy police, writing tickets for sales administration offenders. The next day, he was architecting sales operations and policy for the entire global business. Initially, Mike protested, citing his inexperience with global operations. He confessed he didn't even have a current passport. His protests were ignored. The president told him he was smart and would surely figure all of this out. And he did. The experience was grueling but invigorating. Mike reflected, quote, "I was given an opportunity to do something I'd never done before. In fact, no one had ever done it. The job was huge, but Mike grew into it as predicted by his boss." Polly Sumner was a powerhouse waiting to be unleashed. When a new president joined Oracle, he noticed this channel sales manager's strategic savvy and drive and asked her to assume a vice presidential role, running alliances and strategic partnerships. In time, Polly was right in the middle of a very messy, high-stakes conflict. The management team could not agree on how quickly Oracle would release new versions of its database code to its applications partner and also competitor, SAP. Polly escalated the issue to her new boss, who responded with, quote, "This is a complex issue and probably beyond the scope of your role, but you should be the one to lead the resolution," unquote. She went right to the people who could fix the problem. She found herself brokering a conversation between the billionaire founders and CEOs, Hasso Plattner of SAP and Larry Ellison of Oracle, in a meeting held at Larry's Japanese tea house. The issue was resolved to their mutual satisfaction, and Polly was a superstar. These three individuals all worked for the same boss, but in different settings. Who was the common denominator in this equation? It was Ray Lane, known for challenging his team and for exacting every ounce of their capabilities. When we asked people why they gave Ray so much, their answers revealed a consistent story. He asked them to do jobs that were far bigger than they thought they were. He could spot smarts in others and gave people a chance to stretch well beyond their current capabilities. He gave them ownership, not at the level of their current capabilities, but always one and always two levels up. When investors stretch the role, they stretch the person in it. This bigger role creates a vacuum that must be filled. Invest resources. The moment investors establish an ownership position, they step in and begin investing. They protect their investment by infusing the knowledge and resources the person will need to successfully deliver on their accountability. Teach and coach. When Jay Choi at McKinsey inserts himself into the discussion with the project team, it isn't to show and tell what he knows. He grabs the pen so that he can teach and coach. It is a simple distinction. Diminishers tell you what they know. Multipliers help you learn what you need to know. Jay is not only a business leader, but also an avid teacher who looks for the teachable moments when a team is spinning or has suffered a setback. In these moments, minds are most open and hungry. He contributes a relevant insight or asks just the right question to move the group forward. K.R. Sridhar, CEO of Bloom Energy, has been described several times in previous chapters as another masterful teacher. KR's teaching doesn't occur in a classroom or in a corporate training center. It occurs in the face of very real problems. When the team is wrestling with a technical setback, KR engages not with a solution, but with a thought-provoking question. He asks, what do we know about what doesn't work? What assumptions led us to these outcomes? And what risks do we face now that need to be mitigated? These risks, he pursues these questions in turn, unearthing their individual knowledge and building a collective body of intelligence. KR says, you are teaching by helping your team solve real problems. Even if you know the solution, you don't offer it. If you do, you lost the teaching moment. It has to be Socratic. You ask the question and tease out the answer. Although KR focuses on immediate problems, his investment in these teaching moments returns far more than just solutions to these problems. When leaders teach, they invest in their people's ability to solve and avoid problems in the future. It is one of the most powerful ways that multipliers build intelligence around them. Providing backup. When you think of investing intellectual capital in your direct reports, it is easy to assume that you are the one that needs to provide the capital, but this limits the investment options to what you know and what you have time and energy to invest. Michael Clark, the president of a $12 billion division of Flextronics, is facing market consolidation, and he urgently needed to develop an M&A strategy for his business. He had assigned the process of developing that strategy to his very capable vice president of strategy and new ventures, Becky Roller. She worked tirelessly across 9 different divisions, pulling together the best of their thinking for a joint 2-day strategy session and decision-making forum. But 10 days before the event, the entire process was interrupted when they found out an external consulting firm was leading a company-wide strategy initiative that would complicate their M&A strategy and take it in a different direction. Michael could have jumped in to give extra support, but he suspected that he would be more disruptive than helpful. Instead, he asked Greg Kesey, his vice president for business development, to work 2-in-a-box with Becky. He didn't reduce Becky's ownership. Becky was still fully responsible for the project. But given the latest complexities of this project, having two people's perspective and brain power would be essential. Greg joined Becky for key planning meetings, acting as a sounding board, and offered his support as they navigated the waters. At the completion of the strategy session, Michael praised Becky's leadership and thanks Greg for his backup on this critical project. Watching the management team in action, you could easily imagine the roles reversed next time, with Greg accountable and Becky in the box with him providing backup. When leaders define clear ownership and invest in others, they have sown the seeds of success and earned the right to hold people accountable. Hold people accountable. In working with hundreds of business executives, there's something I've noticed about the finest of these leaders. They all appear to have slanted the tables in their offices. Sure, the desk they sit at with their computer and phone is perfectly flat, but their meetings tables has a distinct slant to it. Perhaps you may not have noticed it, but surely you have seen how accountability for action rolls from their side of the table down to other people, and often directly to you. It may look flat to the unsuspecting eye, but if you placed a marble on one side, the marble would surely roll right off the opposite end. These leaders have a natural leaning to give accountability to others and keep it there. When their people push problems over to the manager's side of the table, by the end of the conversation, these problems slide right back to where they came from. The leader helps, offers suggestions, asks great questions, and may escalate a critical issue, but the accountability slides back and rests with their staff. Their tables slant in the direction of other people. One senior executive I worked for carried a small leather notebook with him every morning. Strangely, he never took meeting notes in it, but every meeting he was mentally present and fully engaged, listened intently, and offered carefully dispensed insights. During these meetings, I would furiously take notes, making careful notation of my action items. Others did the same. On rare occasions, I would see him write a single note in his book. These occasions were reserved for when he alone was accountable for an action. This was the slanted desk in action. This leader knew how to keep the accountability with his people. He was fully engaged and he did not take over. And because he assumed accountability with careful restraint, when he wrote an action down in his little leather book, you could be sure that it would be done by next day at the latest. Give it back. Investors get involved in other people's work, but they continuously give back leadership and accountability. John Wookie is an executive vice president of development at SAP, a veteran of the application software business, and a multiplier who builds organizations with know-how. He knows that delivering software on time and with quality isn't a hands-off job. But he sees a clear distinction between micromanaging and being involved in the work people are doing. One of the breeding grounds for micromanagement is the software development business, is the user interface review meeting. A typical software application has about 250 screens whose usability can make or break a product in the marketplace. So most executives are keenly interested in getting this right. By the end of a user interface review meeting, the micromanaging development executive will have seized the pen, sprung to the whiteboard, and redesigned the screens himself in front of the group as an impressive show of his design savvy. John has seen his former peers and bosses do this countless times. But he makes the investment instead. When John sees problems in the screens, he makes suggestions, discusses options and trade-offs, and then asks the team to go back to their lab and figure it out. John says, "I give people feedback as guidance rather than as an order, because I assume that someone who's been working on something full-time for many weeks has insight into it and won't have after a few minutes." John does offer his insights gained from decades of building business applications and reminds his team to think about what real users need from software. He keeps his guidance focused on what they all can do to build a product and take pride in. John does jump in, but like the partner at McKinsey and Soul, he hands the pen back. By doing so, he signals that he is interested and engaged, but he isn't in charge. He gives it back, and the accountability for designing and building a great product stays with the other person, who incidentally is also built up in the process. Michael Clark, the president of infrastructure at Flextronix, has a clever little two-step process for getting accountability back to people in a way that encourages their continued intellectual contribution. He listens to a presentation or an idea with interest, and then with a rare smile and a thick Yorkshire accent says, quote, "Hey, that is good thinking," unquote. He begins by praising the edge of great thinking. Then he affirms their ownership of the business problem at hand by saying, quote, "I'd love to know whether we should invest in X or invest in Y. I mean, you're smart. You can figure this out," unquote. These words are heard again and again by his team. "You're smart, so you figure it out." Their ideas are validated, and the onus for solving the issue is back with them.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
Every year, countless people succumb to the temptation to purchase exotic animals like hedgehogs, lizards, monkeys, even tigers and bears to keep as pets. But life in captivity is often a death sentence for these animals, who may suffer from malnutrition, an improper environment, and the stress of confinement. For more information on this issue, visit the BCSPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenari, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We're looking at the book Multipliers, How the Best Leaders Make Everyone Smarter by Liz Wiseman, with a foreword by Stephen Covey. We're in the section Multipliers, looking specifically at the investor and how investors act and behave within the company. Expect complete work. It was the summer of 1987, and I had just landed the internship of my dreams. I'd be working for Carrie Patterson, a former professor of organizational behavior at the business school that I attended, who is now running a management training company in Southern California. Carrie was known for his brilliant but slightly demented mind. Carrie's what happens when you pack an Einstein-sized brain into a Danny DeVito-sized body. Everyone wanted to work for Carrie, but he managed to get the job through some combination of faculty recommendation and advanced Jedi mind tricks. I eagerly drove through Southern California to work and study under his mentorship. As in most internship, I did an assortment of odd jobs. I created training content and did computer work and even handled a few stray legal issues. But my favorite job was editing anything that Carrie wrote. Sometimes it might be a training manual. Sometimes it was a speech. But my job was always to edit and find and fix mistakes. On this particular day, I was editing a marketing brochure that Carrie had written. I did the usual edit. I found and fixed typos and grammatical errors. I rewrote a few sentences that appeared awkward to me. Then I stumbled onto a particularly troublesome tangle of words. I tried a couple of times to rewrite the sentences, but I couldn't think of anything better than what Carrie had written. It was too big of a mess for me to fix alone. I figured Carrie, with his great big brain, would know how best to fix it, so I labeled it as awkward by noting the standard editorial term AWK in the margin. I completed my work and returned the document to Carrie's desk. About an hour later, Carrie returned from a meeting to find my edits on his desk. I suspected he had read them because I could hear him marching down the hall toward my office. His pace indicated that he wasn't coming to say thank you. He burst across the threshold and marched right up to my desk. Without so much of his hello, he dropped the document in front of me with a dramatic thump and looked me straight in the eye and said, "Don't ever give me an AWK without an FIX. With a twinkle in his eye, the consummate teacher turned and left my office. Point taken. I worked a little harder, a little longer, applied a little more brain power, and I finally fixed the awkward sentence myself. I snuck back into Carrie's office and returned the now complete edit to his desk. Carrie continued to teach and to write prolifically and is the author of three best-selling books, Crucial Conversations, Crucial Confrontations, and The Influencer. I completed the internship, finished business school, and then made my way into the corporate world, having learned from Carrie one of the most important professional lessons. Never give someone an AWK without also giving them an FIX. Don't just identify the problem. You find the solution. Throughout my management career, I've told this story to dozens of people, perhaps hundreds. I shared it with virtually every person who worked on my team and who dropped a problem on my desk without attaching a solution. I passed it along. Don't ever give me an AWK without an FIX. When we when we ask for the FIX, we give people the opportunity to complete their thinking and their work. We encourage them to stretch and exercise their intellectual muscles that might otherwise atrophy in the presence of other smart, capable people. Multipliers never do anything for their people that their people can do for themselves. Respect natural consequences. Sarah's dad stood up behind his large desk and said loudly with his Australian accent, quote, "I'm not standing for that," unquote. Sarah had expected him to be disappointed with their choice to skip orchestra practice that day. She was tired of wasting 2 or 3 hours of rehearsal when she only had one violin solo at the end. She knew it was mandatory to be at every rehearsal, but thought she wouldn't be missed. When they skipped ahead to her part, she wasn't there, and the conductor had cut her from the concert. But if Sarah's dad was bothered by her choice to go to the gym, he didn't show it. Instead, he said, quote, "That conductor can't just throw you out. And what are you thinking, just accepting it," unquote. He drove her back to see the conductor. When they arrived, the conductor emphatically reiterated her position and said, "Sarah is smart. She knew the rules and made her choice." Sarah's dad tried one tactic after another, but he simply didn't have a case. Sarah didn't say a word. She felt foolish standing there. Having her father make excuses made her feel smaller and less capable. She hadn't liked being cut, but she enjoyed being treated like an adult. She preferred being cut and smart over being saved and dumb. Many corporate managers are like this father. Their well-meaning attempts to help can accidentally diminish people's intelligence and development. They protect people from the natural consequences of their actions, which delays and dilutes the potency of learning. They might step in at the last minute and rework a key presentation a direct report is responsible for producing. They intervene when an internal customer is dissatisfied. All of this subtly tells people that they are not smart enough to figure things out on their own. The next time around, the employee might exert less effort, knowing their manager would step in. Allowing consequences to have their effort allows natural forces to inform intelligent action. It communicates with the manager that people are smart enough to figure things out. People become more independent because they feel they own both the actions and the result and the consequences of their actions. Investors want their investments to be successful. They know they can't intervene and alter natural market forces. By providing the possibility to fail, these leaders give others the freedom and motivation to grow and succeed. Elabin Blatt captured this well when she said, quote, "There are risks in every action. Every success has the seed of some failure," unquote. We'll continue to look at this very interesting book in future shows, so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.